However, I reserved judgment on this subject because I could easily test this talent when we met privately. Finally, he came to the big event of his demonstration. He said that if anyone would volunteer a ring, he would attempt to break it. A lady sitting near us volunteered her costume jewelry ring for the test. She went up on stage, took the ring off her hand, and held it up for all to see. It appeared intact. Yuri then told her to clutch the ring in her hand and to make sure that he could not touch it. This she did. Yuri then placed his left palm over the lady's clenched fist for about 30 seconds. He asked her to open her hand and to examine the ring. She gasped, "The ring is broken." She held it up for all to see. There was wild applause as Yuri ended his demonstration. The lady returned to her seat, and Jakov asked her in Hebrew if we could inspect the ring. She handed it over to us. It was split in two pieces, with no signs of any tool marks. The lady assured Jakov that she was not in collusion with Gela. All this was intriguing, but not convincing, since a magician with the assistance of a confederate could do the same thing. We met Gela after the show. He was very boyish in his eagerness to find out if I liked his show. I assured him that I enjoyed his part of the show, but would have to work with him privately to assess what he was doing. He readily agreed to meet me at my apartment the next day at 1 p.m. to discuss my research interests and find out what I wanted to do. I did not realize then how lucky I was. Later I found out that Yuri had steadfastly resisted all offers by research people to do experiments. He, too, was surprised at how readily he had consented, especially since I was a total stranger. By the time Yuri arrived at the apartment the next afternoon, all of my equipment was operative and in place. Two of my Israeli friends were present, Jakov and Miss Shiframore. I began by asking Yuri to show me those talents of his that he felt the most sure of and to do them in his own way. Yuri said he would like to do some simple telepathy for me. He said, "Think of one number from 1 to 9. Don't tell anyone, just keep it in mind. Got it?" "Yes," I said, "I had thought of the number 4. Now think of another number." "I have it," said I, having thought of the number 3. "Now the last number," Yuri said. "I had selected 2 for this number." Yuri looked at me intently as though he were checking his own impressions, then he said very abruptly to me, "Pick up the pad on the table before you, the one I wrote on before you selected your first number. Did you notice that I had written on it then and haven't touched it since?" "Yes, Yuri, I noticed what you had done and that you haven't touched it since or tried to switch it. After all, that is part of my business as an investigator." I picked up the pad, which was face down, turned it over, and read what Yuri had written down before I had thought of my first number. It read, 432. Yuri laughed, obviously pleased with his coup. I responded with some admiration. "That's pretty clever. You told me this would be telepathy, and I, of course, thought you were going to be the receiver. But you pulled a switch on me." "Ah, you got it quick," interrupted Yuri. "I wanted to send you the numbers, but I knew that if I told you to try to receive the numbers, you would fight me. In this way you participated in the experiment without prejudice, and proved that you have telepathy, when I send or pass to you." I realized now that Yuri had an unusual power of influencing others' thoughts. At this point I asked Yuri's permission to use my tape recorder and movie camera. "Of course, if it is easier for you," he replied quickly. "But you probably think that since I sent those numbers to you so easily, I might also hypnotize you to see and do things that are not really there." "You are so right, Yuri," I laughingly replied. "I can see that we're going to get along just fine." Now that we had tested each other's mettle, we were able to settle down to some serious work. I then asked Yuri to do some more telepathy with my Israeli friends. I might say that these two people were highly trained observers. After an hour of doing Yuri's telepathy with simple units of information such as numbers, letters, colors, and single words, we stopped for a break. We openly discussed our opinion of Yuri's demonstration. I led off by stating without equivocation that this was genuine telepathy and I would state so anywhere. Shifra and Jakov concurred in this opinion. They asked Uri could get or give more complex information by telepathic means. He replied, I can't do things like that. I stick to the simplest bits of things, so that it is like 2 × 2 = 4. Then people have to say I am right or I am wrong. If I do whole stories, it's hard to score what I do. This way it is either 0 or 100, and no in between. Now what would you like to do? I asked Uri. Does anyone happen to have a watch that does not work? I will try to fix it, said Uri. Shifra replied first. I have a watch that is not broken, it is not working because I haven't wounded it in a few days. Can you start it without touching it?
Well, I'll try, said Uri.
I interrupted, Shifra, first let me inspect the watch before anything is done. She handed me the watch. It was a well-known Swiss brand watch. I listened to it. I shook it. This made it tick a few cycles and then it stopped. I then took a motion picture of the face. Uri said, I don't want to touch it. Let Shifra hold it in her clenched fist. I placed the watch in Shifra's open palm. She closed it, and then Uri placed his left hand palm down over her hand without touching it. After 30 seconds Uri said, okay, check it. I think it's running. I took the watch from Shifra and inspected it. The watch ticked now and continued to do so. The hands moved for several minutes normally. Shifra agreed to let me keep the watch to see how long it would run. The watch ran for 30 minutes before it stopped. Uri then asked if I would take my watch off and just hold it in my hand. I noted the time. It was 2:32 p.m. I placed the watch in my right hand. Uri placed his hand over mine without touching it. He concentrated for about 10 seconds, then said, check it. I looked at the watch. The hands now stood at 3:04 p.m., an advance of 32 minutes. My watch is a universal Geneve chronometer, with additional dials to add up stopwatch time. I noticed that two of these dials had also shown an advance of 32 minutes. But the stopwatch sweep second hand should have been running for 32 minutes, but the stopwatch sweep second hand was motionless. There is no known way to advance these two dials 32 minutes except to run the stopwatch for 32 minutes. This complex feat of psychokinesis was unparalleled in my experience, or in the literature, for that matter. This ended our research session for the first day. I had only one reservation. I must wait until my motion pictures were developed to make sure that my companions and I were not hallucinating. 1 month later, when the film was developed, I had my confirmation. The film had seen the same thing as had my eyes. The next day I repeated the telepathy tests and found the same positive results. Then I asked Uri to concentrate on a pair of identical thermometers of the bimetal type. He was able to raise selectively the temperature of one thermometer 6 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit, while the other one remained at the room temperature. I found that he could do this equally well from across the room as when near the thermometer. There was now no question in my mind that Uri Geller's powers of telepathy and psychokinesis were extraordinary. I now wanted to know more about him as a person, what were his interests and his motivation. Uri, you must have thought a great deal about your powers. What is your idea about where they come from? Or how do you think it works?
Yes, I have thought about them. You see, my ideas may seem funny to you because I have only had a high school education. I don't read books. But my ideas are my own, and I don't like to discuss them. I believe that in telepathy I am passing the light speed. I feel that telepathic waves travel at a speed of light or faster. Every object gives off radiation which moves out into the universe. When we pass the light barrier, we can see into the past or into the future, and we can transmute materials one into the other. Everything is based on the light speed. And once beyond that there is no end to what can be done. But as yet, we cannot find the particles beyond the light speed because they are too small. I also believe that there is no limit to the smallness of particles. This is the way I think, but let us not get into theories that we cannot work with. I was quite taken with the depth of Uri's ideas, especially since they were so unexpected. Someday, I said, when we have time, I would like to tell you about Dr. Vinod. a man from India who taught me many things. One of them had to do with superconscious states of mind being due to, or related to, velocities near to the speed of light. What you say about telepathy strikes a responsive chord in me. There is an interesting thing I have noticed, Dr. Puharaj, Yuri interrupted. Sometimes when I break a ring, it loses some of its material. With the breaking of a chain, sometimes a link disappears. Yuri, I saw you break metals with your willpower at the Zorba. Would you try to show me that? I asked. Yes, I would like to do that for you, but a little later, he said. I asked Yuri when he had first decided to show his powers in public. It slowly started in late 1969 when I did some small things for a friend of mine, Shippy Strang. But I really had my first show, with promotion and advertising and all that, in March 1970, because an agent said I could make a lot of money. It was in a movie house in Bat Yam. After a week of this I knew it was easy and I enjoyed it. Then I found that I really need the stimulation of working in front of people in order to do these things. When I am by myself, nothing happens. Now, there are also many people who are opposed to me. They say it is all a fraud and a trick and that I should admit it. But I don't really care whether they believe or don't believe. As you see, I have two things going for me. First, there is my plain, naive appearance. Second, I am a showman and I do have powers. To this candid modesty, I had to add my honest opinion about Yuri. You have not realized your full powers yet. You are just at the beginning. Thank you, Dr. Puharaj, but what else is there for me to do? Everything is written. If we go out of the route, and we leave the third or fourth dimension, we go on into another dimension and another form of life. I believe there is life everywhere in the universe. There are advanced beings who can pass the light barrier, who can travel millions of light years in an instant. They can transfer themselves to different dimensions, they can change themselves into any form they wish, and appear as ants, birds, people, or even UFOs. These space people now know that Earth people are finally advanced enough so that they can show newer forms than they used to take in biblical times. That is, they take different forms now. Yuri, did you ever see these things that you are talking about? I asked. No, to tell you the truth, I never have. I just believe in these things, but I don't know why I do. Yuri went on, I'm talking about these things because I see them in my mind. I believe them. I believe that we live other lives. When our energy runs out in this life, it goes into another dimension. You see, I believe that if you have telepathy, you pass the light barrier, and you go into other dimensions. People ask me, why do you have powers, and I don't? I have an explanation, and I suppose you can say it comes out of four theories, or any one of them. Maybe on our own Earth before the Ice Age, there was a civilization. Very advanced. All that I do now, they once did. Somehow, they have remained, not incorporated in a body, and I somehow have their powers. Then maybe I am a descendant, my ancestors were people not from Earth. They landed in a flying saucer. They had these powers, and somehow they came up in me. This is like a science fiction theory, that I was planted on Earth. Or somehow while growing up, my mind split. Basically it appears okay, but something turned a little away, a little sharper. There is a warp in its makeup. The last one, I don't even want to say it. They are somewhere out there. They have their reasons. This is related to my second idea. Now I will try to split ring for you, Yuri announced in the face of our silence. Jakov's wife, Sarah, had joined us. She offered her gold wedding band. I think she felt that it was perfectly safe, no one could break a ring without touching it. Yuri asked her to clench the ring in her fist. He held his left hand, palm open and down, over Sarah's fist. Yuri said, I know this ring is precious to you. I won't break it badly, I'll just crack it lightly. Tell me, do you feel anything? Sarah said after about 30 seconds, I feel some tingling in my palm. Okay, I think it is broken. Open your fist, said Yuri. We all crowded around Sarah. I picked up the ring first. There, clearly across the yellow gold, was a crack in the metal. Now I felt the full impact of Ori's powers. The Gordian knot had been cut. Several months later I got a report on the ring from the metallurgist at the Stanford University Department of Materials Science. It stated that there was no known way to cause this kind of fracture and that the electron microscope pictures were unique. I spent my remaining few days repeating each of the tests with Ori that I had already done, just to make sure that I was not being fooled. I wanted to make arrangements for future research with Ori. He was quite willing to work with me. I decided that the preliminary research should be done right in Israel, and Ori concurred. Before I left Israel, Yuri proudly showed me his scrapbook of news clippings. One story from Israel's leading newspaper, Maariv, of February 19, 1971, caught my eye. It was about Captain Edgar D. Mitchell, the Yuri Geller of the astronauts. I told Ori that I would be talking to Captain Mitchell on my return to the States. Since I had to be in France on August 24, I did not have much time. I had to reach key figures in the government to make sure that I would have their cooperation. Jakov understood totally what had to be done in Israel, and he undertook to be my emissary. I left for France on the understanding that if he could arrange a meeting for me with certain key figures, I would return to Israel. At the International Conference in St. Paul de Vence, I was especially interested in a report by Dr. Hans Spender on a phenomenon that involved recording on a tape recorder voices whose origin was unknown. Dr. Bender told me of a man in Germany, Dr. Konstantin Rohrdyve, who was doing such work. I decided to go see Dr. Rohrdyve right after the conference. At the conference I met a young parapsychologist from the University of Wisconsin, Ayla Zibo, who impressed me very much with her quick wit and good judgment. But more of her later, when she enters this story as a principal. I did not report on my work with Geller at the conference, since I felt it was premature to say anything about his startling powers. I knew that, paradoxically, the bigger his powers, the more proof it would take to be convincing. From the conference I flew to Zurich, where I met my friend and assistant of many years, Melanie Toyofaku, to do some work with Dr. Rohrdyve. I phoned Dr. Rohrdyve and found that he was able to see me for the coming week. Since I had all my research equipment with me from the work in Israel, I was prepared to join Dr. Rohrdyve immediately. Melanie and I drove down along the Rhine to Bad Krozingen, where Dr. Rohrdyve lived and worked. Bad Krozingen is a spa built for chronically ill people, and I did not like its atmosphere. Therefore, as was my habit, I simply drove around the area looking for an inn that suited my mood. At sunset I drove into a small town which was guarded by a castle high on a hill. It had a warm rustic atmosphere. I found an inn that had rooms free, and Melanie and I settled in. The next morning we were having breakfast at a sidewalk cafe in the village square when we inquired as to the name of the town. The waiter informed us that it was Staufen and was famous as the place in which Dr. Johannes Faustus had lived in the 16th century. Dr. Konstantin Rohrdyve was a Latvian philosopher living in Bad Krozingen because of his wife's disability. Although he spoke many languages, English did not come easily to him, so we settled on French for our discussions, with Melanie serving as the interpreter. Dr. Rohrdyve explained how he was able to record the voices of people who had died. He used an ordinary tape recorder with a diode placed in series with the input jack. Sometimes he used the tape recorder with an ordinary microphone input, but this created too much noise in the recording, with the result that the voices were buried in the noise level of the electronic system. Therefore, one had to train oneself to hear the signal in the noise. It took me about 12 hours of such training to hear the voices that Dr. Rohrdyve said were there. At last Melanie and I were able to hear the voices without any help from Dr. Rohrdyve. On August 31, 1971, Dr. Rohrdyve conducted an experimental session in which we would try to record spirit voices on my Sony TC-120 tape recorder. The procedure was simple. The tape recorder was placed on a coffee table, and we sat around it. The recorder was started, and Dr. Rohrdyve simply said, "We would like to have a message for Miss Melanie." We waited 2 minutes and then played back the tape recording. All of us distinctly heard the words Melanie,
yes, following Dr. Ordive's last words. Melanie said the two words had the voice quality of her deceased Japanese grandmother who had never learned to speak English properly. Following this attempt, the tape recorder was started again, and I asked for my mother, Rose, who had died in 1956, but I spoke in Croatian, the language in which she and I had spoken so often. When the tape was played back, we heard the phrase in Croatian to Rosalia, and to my ear it had the voice quality of my mother as I remembered it. The phrase meant "This is Rose." We went on working in this fashion for two more days with similar results. I was totally convinced that the effect was genuine. However, I was forced to the conclusion that in order for the effect to occur, Dr. Ordive's presence was required. This meant that we were dealing with a two-termed process in which one term was an instrument, the tape recorder, and the other term was a human being, Dr. Ordive. For example, the same effect did not occur with me at this time. A person who has such a special effect is called a medium. A medium serves as a bridge between this material world and the world of the unknown, from which the voices came. The fact that one needed a medium did not make the effect less valid, it just introduced the factor of special human dependency. After our final sessions with Dr. Ordive, I left for London and from the drove to Cambridge University to discuss my findings on Uri Geller with a group of friends whom I considered to be on the cutting edge of knowledge advancement. I met with Ted Bastin, a physicist, Chris Clark, a cosmologist, Margaret Masterman, a philosopher and linguist, and Richard Braithwaite, a philosopher, and others. My data on the Geller effects were received with great interest as a possible contribution to a fundamental revision in philosophy and in science. We began to make plans for the kind of research that we would have to do in future years, just to build a new database for the new science to come. On September 12, I got a phone call in London from Jakov, who was in Israel. He said he had made contact with the right Israeli authorities and that I should return immediately for a discussion. On September 13, I had extensive discussions with a key government figure in Tel Aviv about research with Uri. He told me that there was a consensus among his colleagues that the kind of things Uri Geller was doing should be taken seriously from a scholarly point of view and that I could count on cooperation in my program from his government. I was encouraged to return to Israel, to try to organize a research program on my own. On September 14, I picked up a copy of the Herald Tribune in Tel Aviv and read a story by Walter Sullivan. It said that some American and Soviet scientists had called an international conference to consider the possibility of communicating with life on other worlds. The meeting had been held in Baikonur in the Soviet Union. Many distinguished scientists were in attendance, including Dr. Charles Townes, Nobel laureate from the University of California, Berkeley. This was the first time that such a conference had ever been held at so high a level. I did not try to do any research with Uri on this trip, but spent our time together simply trying to get to know him better. I also met his two closest friends, Hannah and Shippy Strang. It was easy to see that a tight bond held these three together, and I knew that any plans for work with Uri in the future would necessarily have to include Hannah and Shippy. By September 20, I was back in my home in Ossining. The next 2 months were a blur of activity in which I saw people all over the United States and Canada, trying to enlist their interest and support for the Geller research in Israel. Most of my professional colleagues simply did not accept my data on Geller, even after viewing my films of his effects on watches, metal breakage, etc. I soon discovered the reason: they were threatened. If Geller were true, then the very foundations of science would have to be questioned. One of the more open minds was that of Captain Edgar D. Mitchell, who had just completed the Apollo 14 mission to the Moon in February. He and I met for the first time in Houston, where he told me that he had completed the first Moon-Earth telepathy experiment. He had been the sender in space to four human receivers based on Earth. He told me that the results had been just as I had predicted 10 years earlier in my book Beyond Telepathy. He was most enthusiastic about the prospects of doing research with Uri, and we made some plans to do so.
By November 17, I had completed all the complex tasks necessary to launch a long-term research effort in Israel with Uri, and was on my way back to Israel. My goals were now quite clear. I had to make arrangements with the Institutes of Higher Learning in Israel to get them to work with Uri. It was essential that others participate in the process of validating Uri's powers, and Uri had to become accustomed to working with scientists. By 7:30 p.m. November 19, 1971, I was settled in Reuven's apartment in Tel Aviv. The next day I was scheduled to start a series of meetings with Uri, Jakov, Reuven, and others to plan how to accomplish all the goals I had set. Little did I know at this moment as I settled into bed that my lifelong quest for true knowledge was about to commence. Chapter 3, Dakishim. I met with Uri on November 20, 1971, and outlined to him my plans for research. I explained that I would need him for 3 to 4 hours every day. He agreed to make this time available if I could tolerate odd hours that he would salvage around his public demonstrations. I agreed to this if I could also attend all his public demonstrations, which was acceptable to him. We decided on the compensation for his demonstrations for me. Then I explained to him the rules of being a research subject. First, it was not to be a game between us. Since we were both interested in the truth, we had to be brutally honest with each other. On my part, one would not pull any surprises on him. I would state my goals for each experiment and what I expected him to do. If he could not do it, or did not feel like doing a test, he was to tell me immediately. Experiments would have to be repeated until I felt I had enough data, and of such quality as to be fit to introduce into any court as evidence. This meant that he would have to submit to my testing conditions and not to break them during a test. Uri said, "I understand what scientists have to do, but I don't know if I can do it. You see, I can only do what I feel I am able to do. If I don't feel like it, I can't do it." "Fine," I replied. "That is why I want to make my goals clear to you before each test so that there is no misunderstanding. Let me show you by example how I work. The last time we worked, I let you determine the conditions under which you demonstrated. Now we will do the same kind of telepathy test, but I will control the conditions. We will do a telepathy test in which I will think of a 3-digit number, and you will try to guess what these numerals are. You take this blank pad and pencil and go into the next room. I will stay here with a pad and pencil. When I say go, I will write down 3 digits, and at the same time you will write down the first 3 digits that come to your mind. Is this clear?" "I understand," said Uri, as he took the pad and pencil and went to the next room. I shouted go and without thinking, wrote down 6-3-1-inch on my pad. Uri came out of the room a minute later and said, "That is very fast. I usually work much slower. But here is my paper." I laid his paper alongside my paper, mine, 6-3-1, Uri's, 6-3-1. "This is a hit," I said. No one could question the results, except to accuse us of being in collusion. But even that possible weakness in the test can be eliminated by bringing in a third party. Besides that, I will document each test with recordings, both audio and videotape. I am going to rent an apartment in Herzliya Heights, and it will take me 2 days to set it up as a laboratory. All right. Let's have dinner tomorrow evening and start research on the 22nd, he offered. I agreed on the time and place, and Uri was off. I rented a car and went to look at the apartment that Jakov had located. I liked it. It was a new high-rise apartment called the Herzliya Heights apartment, and I sublet apartment 61 on the 6th floor. This apartment had a striking night view of Tel Aviv 10 kilometers to the south and a day view of the Mediterranean a kilometer to the west. In 2 days I converted the large living room into a laboratory. On the evening of the 21st we met for dinner. Uri had brought along Aris Davidesse, an 18-year-old fashion model who was his girlfriend and for whom he had a very tender affection. Jakov's friend, Reuven, joined us in Jakov's stead and brought along Jeda Ornstein, a woman who had healing and psychic powers. Jeda had been born in Russia, was brought up in China, then married and moved to Chile. She had been imbued with something of each culture before coming to Israel 3 years before. At dinner in a restaurant, Yuri had Jeddah hold her gold ring in her clenched fist while he concentrated on it.